Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are listening to your community radio station, KBOO Portland. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the following hour. Every week, the Moles bring you views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial perspective. Today, we find ourselves at the end of one long political haul and at the beginning of a new one with a rather uncertain outcome. We're in a time that is at once full of democratic openings and significant anti-democratic threats. Today, the Moles are going to look at some of the opportunities we have to push back against those threats and build a better world. Lori Mercier will be talking with Chelsea Ratzliff about the visiting writers of color who will be coming to Washington State University in an online program open to the public. Desiree Helligers will interview anesthesiologist Dr. Angèle Teilhard about COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter at Oregon Health Sciences University. And finally, book mole Larry Bolden will take us back in time with his review of a novel, The Orphan's Tale, about circuses and female solidarity during the Nazi era. First up, Bill Resnick speaks with Joel Bleifuss, the editor of the journal In These Times, on the challenges Biden faces, marginalizing the right and Trumpism, stopping the pandemic, reviving the economy, creating jobs for all, and combating racism. All of this must be done while jumpstarting a reconstruction of U.S. productive systems and ways of life in order to stop global roasting and do it within the 10-year time frame climate scientists tell us we have. Resnick and Bleifuss then take up what the left can do to push the Congress and Biden's basically corporate conservative administration to meet those challenges.
Hello, Joel Bleifuss. Welcome to KBOO here in Portland, Oregon.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Joel Bleifuss is the editor and publisher of the left monthly journal In These Times, where he has worked his way up since 1986, over his 34 years. In These Times has published thousands of pieces suggesting ways to make this a more equal, just, democratic country. Indeed, if put in a package and implemented in this country, it would be a model for building that better, necessary, possible, democratic, sustainable country we could and need to become. But today the country is in deep, deep trouble. As Biden takes office, the situation and its politics couldn't be more challenging. There's the COVID epidemic, 400,000 people already dead, our fast declining economy, a vast increase in possible in the already millions of homeless is now looming. On top of that, climate change, it's rapidly intensifying. It has to be stopped, say the climate scientists, within the next 10 years. Our criminal justice system, it's deeply unjust, especially to people of color. And on top of all that, Trump generated a growth, radicalization, and organization of the extreme right with white supremacist nationalist leadership that sees the pandemic and climate change as hoaxes. And they're attempting to infiltrate the police and military on the way to their goal of taking over this country. And they learned a lot in their failed and sometimes comic attack on the Capitol building. So Joe Biden, in response to those challenges, our new president could do a lot through executive orders and by changing energy agency policy. Indeed, he could do a lot about immigration and climate change just by reversing Trump's executive orders. But also much must be done through Congress passing laws, like, in fact, the $1.9 trillion COVID relief package that would provide monies to pay the rent and buy food for millions of people who are now unemployed and getting destituted. And it also gives funds to the states for administering vaccine shots and supporting state services. State revenues are way down. But the Congress is quite conservative. Most of the Democratic Party members they're men and women who became accustomed to serving the corporations and the rich, and they even came to believe that it will all trickle down. Indeed, Biden himself has a terrible record, support for the Iraq War, support for increases in the military budget, support for long mandatory criminal punishments for relatively minor crimes, also for trade deals, for welfare reform, and on, and he doesn't apologize. In his campaign, he opposed Medicare for All and opposed the Green New Deal. Well, it must be said for Biden that he did promise some fundamental changes in climate change policy and in transforming our medical system. The long and short of it is that Biden and the Congress have to be pushed hard to do anything meaningful. And Joe Blyfus, my guest today, has written on just that. So, Joe Blyfus, tell us about the Congress. Tell us about their political center of gravity and how they have to be pushed. But not all Congress people are conservative. There's a progressive caucus, as you point out in the January In These Times. It could gain leverage, could exercise a great deal of power. Tell us how they could do it.
I think that progressives often feel that nothing's changed, that the Democratic Party has ossified and that things haven't progressed. But I think if you take like a 30-year look, back in 1991, Bernie Sanders and four other members of Congress established a Congressional Progressive Caucus. Today, in 2021, it's the largest caucus within the Democratic Party in Congress. And within that group are some very committed progressives. The caucus has reorganized itself. It's going to start requiring new things of its member, and it's going to become a much more potent force, which I think is great for progressive legislation because it'll provide a counterbalance to, say, the sort of more moderate Republicans that will work with Biden, and he will now receive pressure from this sort of congressional, well-organized progressive group in Congress. At the same time, of course, social movements will be on the streets and campaigning, going door to door, putting pressure on their elected officials and the administration to move faster and more bravely and more directly to address the many needs of this country.
Yeah, you just pointed out it would provide a counterweight to the Republicans and some of the conservative Democrats that Biden is certain to depend on. My sense is, how large is the Progressive Caucus?
It's about 100, and there are various levels of commitment. But clearly, if a large group of Democratic congressmen decided they weren't going to support a bill because it was too conservative, they would be joined by conservative Republicans who won't support it because it's a Democratic initiative. And so they have real influence to halt legislation or anything that's going on that they disagree strongly with. Of course, there's going to be compromise, and I'm sure that the Progressive Caucus will be supporting things that they don't believe are ideal, but which are better than the alternative.
Yeah, let's go into that a little bit more. It seems to me that if the Biden medical bill does not include, let's say, medical proposals and doesn't include the promise and that, let's say, the Department of HEW, the promise would be to the Progressive Caucus that the Department of HEW would make waivers available to the states to set up Medicare for All programs. Vermont did try it. They needed more money, said one apologist. Vermont did get the waivers, but they never did set up the program. Their reason was they couldn't get enough money. It was a very big disappointment. there would also have to be some money available for the planning. But it seems to me, even if Biden didn't try, quote, who Medicare for all, which is very unlikely, the Progressive Caucus could demand that waiver. So some states could, in fact, and there are several states where there's sentiment in the legislatures to do it. Is that the kind of action
That's one thing that the Progressive Caucus could do. I mean, another thing would just simply have a public option, and that the thinking goes that because the public option would be much more efficient and cost-effective, that would put pressure on the industry itself and provide sort of a solid step toward Medicare for all.
Yeah, either of those are very attractive, it seems to me, and are the kind of reforms that really have meaning and that could lead to something far more sweeping.
There are also reforms that are very popular with people, and I think it's important for the Democratic Congress and Biden to, you know, demonstrate right off the bat that they are concerned with the tragedy that so many Americans are living currently.
Yeah, let's talk about one other area of climate change. Climate science has warned us that unless we take action within the next 10 years, really sweeping action, dramatic action, way beyond the Paris Agreement, we could be facing an irreversible global roasting that would, at minimum, lead to the death of most human beings. And Biden seems to realize the gravity of the situation, although he campaigned saying he didn't agree with the Green New Deal. That may be just a campaign. He couldn't appear too, I think they all thought they couldn't appear too radical, and maybe they were right. A lot of the left doesn't think so. But anyway, what they could do, it seems to me, in terms of climate change, that would be very, very significant, is to fund in any appropriation bill for infrastructure, even COVID relief, put a few $20 billion, whatever it is, for creating some model zero carbon cities with community energy and a few larger utility scale plants in adjacent areas, no vast grid, where communities, in fact, could control their own energy. That appropriation and plan could be very important because it would show the rest of America what could be done, which is very important if we're ever going to decide to really mobilize. I have the sense that that's one of the key things that a progressive caucus could go for. What's your sense of how climate change is going to play out?
Well, I think part of the advantage that the climate change movement has going for it is that there are economic incentives, there are economic reasons to switch from oil to solar or wind or hydropower. And those reasons are driving the development of alternative energy resources. And so it's very important that what Congress can do, it can get rid of the sort of structural advantages that it gives the petroleum industry and all of its adjunct parts, and sort of even the playing field, because without state support, the oil industry would be not nearly as profitable as it is now, and it's not profitable now because the price of oil is so low. So I think that there's sort of market forces that could be employed very effectively to make sort of a green energy, which is job creating, much more efficient and affordable.
Yeah, by just reducing all those subsidies that they get. This is Bill Resnick for the Ilmo Variety Hour talking to Joel Bleifuss, the editor, publisher of the Left Monthly magazine In These Times. We've been discussing how both Biden and the Congress are both conservative, have very conservative records and indeed worldviews. But they have a Trojan horse in their midst, the Congressional Progressive Caucuses of close to 100 members. Some are more committed than others. Still, it's a large caucus. It could win some very important programs. And it seems to me that's more possible because Biden and the Congress people have just experienced what I see as a come-to-Jesus moment when they were huddling together in the sub-basements of the Capitol building with armed soldiers, automatic assault rifles at the door protecting them as the Trump radicalized mobs ransacked through the building, some looking for congresspeople to, who knows what to do, what they would do when they, if they had found them. My sense is that these congresspeople suddenly came to realize the great danger of Trump and the right, and that, in fact, that so many U.S. North Americans are furiously angry. They're led by white supremacists. They could well take over this country, even win the next election. In fact, that's likely unless Biden and the Congress take major steps to stop the decline in living conditions and life security and dignity for the bottom 70% of the people. Just saying no to anything that would really aid working people while saying yes to corporate tax breaks, and that's no longer going to get them elected. So, Joe Blythus, am I right? You think that there's a fear going through them, and that would lead to them actually supporting progressive policies?
I guess I'm not so optimistic. I think that, of course, the invasion or the insurrection of the Capitol shook a number of people, and I think that there will be no sort of more public scrutiny of the sort of rise of white supremacists. But I don't see any change really coming from the Republican Party, and other than maybe for a few senators who are up for re-election in 2022, because they've sort of benefited by this voter suppression, this sort of tacit white supremacy through their Southern strategy. And now the Republican Party is reaping the results of their policy, and the party is splintering between those who are sort of in touch with reality and conservative and those who are totally irrational and followers of Trump. So I think there is a fear that Trump could win, their Trump folks could win again, but I'm hopeful that the Republican Party is so divided that that's not going to be possible.
Yeah, well, that's the optimistic view, I think.
I always think the glass is half full.
Yeah, it's always half full. I agree. It's a half-empty part that bothers me. Anyway, you know it's a great Gramsci line, which he didn't speak. It's optimism of the will and the intellect. Of course, pessimism and the intellect, too.
The mind. Right.
Anyway, so Blythus.
Got a great quote for you. We have a story that we're publishing by the head of Wisconsin Citizen Action. It's sort of a strategy thing. And he writes how A. Philip Randolph asked FDR, who was a civil rights leader, asked FDR what he could do to intervene against soul-crushing racial oppression. And FDR told Randolph, "I agree with everything you said, but I would ask one thing of you, Mr. Randolph, and that's to go out and make me do it," end quote. And so I think that's a really important thing to understand about politicians, is that they respond to pressure, and they aren't going to do anything that they're not pressured to do if it also will cost them something. And so I think progressives have to be a lot more sort of nuanced and sophisticated about understanding how politicians work and understanding that they rely on direct pressure from people, and that if they don't act the way you want them to, it's because they haven't been pressured to do so, not necessarily because they won't.
You just introduced the last issue that I was hoping to talk about. It's left movements that will carry the day if they're large enough and disciplined enough and militant enough, as was the Great March of Washington in 1963. It scared the hell out of the assembled, mostly older white conservative people who serve. I'm hoping that the left movements, I have the vision that over the next month our movements, I have the hope that over the next months our movements apply maximum pressure on those elected officials. And hopefully when the pandemic is stopped, maybe in midsummer, late summer, our pent-up demand will express itself in great rallies and marches across the country and not accept no from our elected leaders to do something. The people now have absorbed the lessons of the great George Floyd eruptions. when you're in the streets and you have a righteous cause, the politicians are forced to respond, although you have to, of course, keep up the pressure. Bill Blankfuss, what do you see as the possibilities for that and the necessity and possibilities of left movements providing that maximum pressure and really erupting in mobilizations?
I think the possibilities for progressives to come together both on the outside and on the inside of, you know, on the outside of power and on the inside of power, meaning Congress, has never been higher. And that's what's often referred to as an inside-outside strategy. You have folks on the inside who are pushing for institutional change through the legislative process, and you have people on the outside who are clamoring in the streets for change and demanding it of their communities and societies and elected leaders. And I think that we saw in the 2020 presidential election and that this huge mobilization to oust Trump from office shows the movement sort of combining both an inside and outside approach at the same time, and that they understand the power of the legislation and understand that, you know, real change can't happen without legislative change, but they, at the same time, they understand that the legislature itself can't change unless there's pressure from the outside.
Joe Blankfuss, thanks so much for talking to us today. Congratulations on In These Times. It's an important journal of the left.
I'd just like to say that In These Times, all of our content is put on the web for free. We have no paywalls. We're a public service, a reader-supported magazine. Check us out online, inthesetimes.com.
Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you.
You too.
That was Bill Resnick with Joel Blankfuss talking about what the left can do to push forward a progressive agenda. And the music was, of course, Leonard Cohen singing about the coming of democracy. He sang about that for a very long time. Next up, Laurie Mercier speaks with Chelsea Ratzlaff about the Washington State University Visiting Writers Series, which is bringing a lineup of writers of color to the university starting next week.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking with Chelsea Ratzlaff from Washington State University, Vancouver, who is one of the organizers of an upcoming Visiting Writers Series featuring writers and poets of color beginning this Wednesday, January 27th. Hi, Chelsea. Tell us about the series for this spring 2021.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me. So the Visiting Writer Series this semester, we're really excited about it. It's a collaboration across multiple WSU campuses that organizers have been dreaming about for a long time. Pavithra Narayan, DJ Lee, Peter Chilson, Cameron McGill have been doing a lot of this work for many years, and we're excited to bring a diverse group of writers and scholars to the community.
Well, tell us about some of the people who will be here this spring. I know that Rika Aoki is speaking on Wednesday. Can you say something about her work and about the other people who will be coming in the next few months?
Yeah, so Rika Aoki is going to be joining us next Wednesday, January 27th. She's a poet, a composer, a teacher, and an author of several books, including Seasonal Velocities, Why Death Shall Never Settle Upon the Soul, Himelia Hilo, and others. And then on February 10th, we have Nigerian writer Chigozie Obioma. His debut novel, The Fisherman, is being translated into more than 26 languages, We're really excited to hear from him. And then on March 1st, we have poet Major Jackson, whose work explores human intimacy in war and focuses on ordinary American citizens whose perseverance make them remarkable and transcendent. He has many, many works of poetry as well, including Roll Deep, Holding Company, Hoops, and others. And then on March 16th, we have creative nonfiction writer Katina Bay-Cote, whose work focuses on personal history, social history, and personal story. And then on March 23rd, C.S. Chisholm is joining us. He's a poet and nonfiction writer who's won many awards, including the American Book Award, for his poetry collection Prairie Style. And then on April 7th, we have performance poet Mahogany L. Brown, who's also a writer, organizer, vocalist, and author of poetry and young adult fiction. She's also director of Black Lives Matter at Pratt Institute. And then our final speaker is joining us on April 12th. Her name is Deborah Magpie Earling. She's Native American and a member of the Salish and Kootenai tribes of the Flathead Reservation in Montana. Her novel, Permared, has won many awards, including the American Book Award, and her other project, The Lost Journals of Sacagawea, reinvents the life of Sacagawea, in collaboration with a photojournalist, Peter Rudelich Coach. So we're really looking forward to this series.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing lineup of fantastic writers and poets. And so I'm sure folks will want to tune in, and we'll provide that information in just a minute. But since Rika Aoki is speaking this Wednesday, do you want to say something more about her work, what people might expect to hear her talk about?
Yeah, Rika Aoki is extremely multi-talented. She's a musician, a poet, and she has many different kinds of books. Her first collection, Seasonal Velocities, is a collection of essays and poems, short stories, letters. So she's really resisting traditional categories in literature. She's also been recognized by the California State Senate for her extraordinary commitment to the visibility and well-being of transgender people. She's Japanese American. She also happens to be a former national judo champion, and she's taught self-defense seminars. She's been featured in several documentaries, and she's just really funny and bold and courageous, and I know that she'll bring a lot of joy to her talk, so we're really looking forward to having her.
And that will be this Wednesday, the 27th, at what time?
At 6 p.m.
And all of these events are free and open to the public. There's no registration required, and they'll be streamed on YouTube Live, so they're very accessible for folks. And how can people find out more about not only Rika Aoki's talk coming up, but the entire series for the next few months?
Yeah, good question. So people can go to english.wsu.edu/visiting-writers, and that will give you the full schedule of speakers, and you'll get to read their bio, and their links for each talk will be on there as well.
And so this is the Washington State University Visiting Writers Series. We'll post a link to that on the Old Mole website. Thanks so much for joining us today, Chelsea.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Yes, it's fun when you're young beneath an innocent sun, and the unicorns play in the fields, and your daddy drives slow with his Cadillac soul, his big strong hands on the wheel. And life's a dream, a serene machine that all seem to care how you feel. And then you grow up and it's never enough, and money is just something to steal. It's every man for himself, so grab the wealth, feel the poor under your heel. It's a brand new deal,
a brand new deal.
That was a clip from Madeline Peru from her song entitled Brand New Deal, about the lies and the rules we all grew up with. Before that, Lori Mercier and Chelsea Ratzliff gave us the scoop on the writers of color who will be visiting WSU beginning next week in a program open to the public. And now Desiree Halliger's interviews Dr. Angèle T. Teilhard, Medical Director of Neuroanesthesiology and Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine at the OHSU School of Medicine, about working in the trenches of the battle against COVID-19 and the challenges of making Black Lives Matter in medicine.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Angèle Teilhard, who is the Medical Director of Neuroanesthesiology and an Assistant Professor of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine at the OHSU School of Medicine. Dr. Teilhard, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Desiree.
You have been working in the trenches now for months as an anesthesiologist at OHSU. That has got to have taken, I would imagine, like an amazing both physical and emotional toll, especially given your role in intubating patients who are going on ventilators.
Yes, it's been a process. And when you ask that question, it explains to me why I am actually tired. It, you know, something like this, you know, when you're working in the hospital, particularly as an anesthesiologist, it's a very dynamic experience. And there's really no time to stop, even for something like COVID. And so I remember very well being called in an emergency situation to intubate a patient. And one day you're in the intensive care unit, you're intubating someone, and you see that there is massive inflammation in the airway, which is like opening to the larynx and the trachea. And you see it, you know, very inflamed, very beefy red, and you're not wearing any protection except for what you normally wear, which is maybe your hat. And then 2 days later, when everyone's kind of coming together with this COVID-19 disease, and now you have all of this PPEs are here, and you just keep thinking, oh my goodness, was I exposed to this thing that I'm not sure what it is? And then you spend all this time reading and reading and finally hear, oh, it's about a 9 to 14 day incubation. So you just keep counting the days, hoping. And, you know, as a healthcare worker, you're very aware of the risk, but, you know, the focus is always the patient and you're always thinking about it. But this is an extra layer of stress when you start thinking about bringing this home to your family. Being on the front line, an emergency is an emergency. And, you know, initially there was no testing. So the recommendation was everyone is COVID suspect. So you treat everyone like they have COVID. And, you know, that means you do everything you can to protect yourself. But, you know, you have your family. So, you know, if I was on backup call, which I was a few times, as things were kind of starting to kind of ramp up and people were learning more about this. And so I would come home, I would go straight into the shower, I would put all my stuff to wash, and a couple times I was on backup call, I'd have to go back 2 or maybe 3 times. That means every time I would change out of my scrub, put my clothes on, come home, because I was in a hospital that was probably more concentrated with COVID, I'm going to assume, I would put all my stuff in the laundry, take a shower, and then I could talk to my kids and my family. So you really start to become aware of the risk that you pose to your family and the outside environment. So it was very easy for me when they were talking about mask everywhere to comply. That was not even a question. It takes a huge toll. And I think sometimes as physicians, we tend to kind of numb ourselves to that, thinking that we're just used to it. But it really, at the end of the day, when we're sitting down in a chair and we're having a hard time getting up, you have to come to terms with what it takes from you. It's really, really difficult. And the next day, you do it again and again and again. And some days are much more taxing than other days, and you still have to do it, and you want to come back and have something left to give to your family. So it definitely very, very, very challenging. And COVID has added to that angst. And I do worry about the impact that that type of toll can take on people for a long period of time, like it has. I think we're in month 8 or 9 now.
Yeah, I mean, can we throw into that the ways in which being a physician or healthcare provider of color is also like really compounding, I would imagine, the roles of to be a woman who is a woman of color in that setting. I would imagine that just the daily toll of microaggressions and, you know, other kinds of stresses of just being Black in the U.S., or being a person of color in the U.S. Has got to put people at even higher risk of that in terms of that daily stress.
Yes, it does. The end of May, George Floyd was strangled, the knee to his neck, and it was televised everywhere. This is all happening at the same time. People talk about this vicarious racism and the stress that you start to internalize that actually affects you. So as a physician, you're thinking about COVID, you're thinking about your family, you're thinking about taking care of patients, you're thinking about patients being sick, and then you're thinking about systemic racism and Black Lives Matter. And then I remember one night my daughter's you know, we came home and my daughter's like, you know, we have to go protest. And parents are saying, no, I want you to stay in. I'm thinking of COVID and I'm also thinking about tear gas and whatever else is going to happen out there. And they're 21 and 19 and they're saying, we have to. And so can I tell you how you feel at 8 o'clock as the sun is setting, going to work tomorrow and I'm thinking my kids are out. And but I'm giving them room to be able to deal with this thing that is so awful.
A lot of data about, for example, low birth weight among African-American babies, right? And the ways in which the single variable that they've linked that to is the lifelong toll of racism. And so, you know, we know that healthcare workers in the era of COVID, healthcare workers of color are dying at disproportionate rates to white workers. I mean, there could be sort of multiple layers of that. But you work particularly with medical residents. Are you seeing the impacts of Black Lives Matter in the context of OHSU, in the context of training future healthcare workers?
In response to the disparities of COVID, as well as the issue of systemic racism as manifest by the public display of the death of George Floyd, medical centers are looking at this charge that they've had on the table for quite some time to make the healthcare workforce more diverse. And so it's causing a lot of these centers to look at their policies and their practices in this quest to become anti-racist. So it's very important to look at where we're at in terms of Blacks in medicine. So if you look at medical school graduates, somewhere around 6-7% of medical school graduates are Black versus 50% are white. And then you kind of look the next step after medical school, you graduate from medical school, you become a resident. 4% of residents are Black. So the number goes down. And then you look recent information from the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. You see that Black residents, this is data from 2019, Black residents are dismissed disproportionately compared to whites. In 2015, more than 20% of residents dismissed for whatever reason were Black. And they were in surgery, pediatrics, internal medicine, and anesthesiology. This was on Twitter for several weeks. And so there's this movement to try to increase representation, but what is happening within these spaces during their education? And this is what I'm constantly kind of thinking about, is the educational space that they're in supportive of these trainees so that, one, they get through their residency, and even more importantly, they become faculty of color to mentor the next generation of underrepresented groups. And when I think about that, it makes me think it's more than just promoting diversity, but it's actually making sure that these residents and trainees are in spaces that promote inclusion and equity and support. So there are a lot of barriers that people talk about, and the barriers to the success of underrepresented learners in medicine, a big part of the problem is implicit bias, lack of mentorship. These things lead to isolation within medicine. And it's interesting, we talk a lot about isolation now in terms of COVID. And so when I think about the underrepresented in medicine, and I'm thinking they've already been getting through their residency and their training, many of them experiencing bias and feeling very isolated. And then now we add COVID and just the social isolation courtesy of this pandemic. And that is just an even more of a burden. There was a survey of over 7,000 surgical residents in the United States, and I think it was 2018, 2019, and 16% of those residents reported racial discrimination. And I think there was like 30% was discrimination based on their gender. And then when you take that one step further, which the authors did, they went and just looked at what are some of the effects of that. And a number of these residents who reported discrimination based on their ethnicity or their race also had feelings of burnout, depression, and suicidal thoughts. There have been a number of studies that painted a pretty clear association between burnout, depression, and the incidence of medical errors. If we don't address what is happening inside these spaces and really do more to try to create an environment that is supportive of our underrepresented in medicine. If they do make it, that's fantastic. But the harm that's caused, that for some is compelling them to leave medicine, is a problem, as well as problem for them to try to thrive against these, to me, almost insurmountable odds where they're being committed to an atmosphere that doesn't support them and that actually creates the potential for harm that can be transferred to the care of patients. So to me, it's a real serious commitment that all of our educational systems really need to look at their environment that they're bringing these medical students and these residents in. They're making a lot of efforts to bring them in, but they've got to finish, and they've got to finish healthy and well and be able to be the best physicians that they can possibly be. So COVID is reminding us how serious this is because patients are suffering because of COVID. There's no question. I think as of January 2021, just this past January, we have 16% of COVID deaths are African Americans. And that group is 13% of our U.S. population. That's a problem. And there are a number of socioeconomic determinants and health disparities that are contributing to this. So that has to be looked at. It has to be done in parallel, all together. So the work that we have to do, I think, is tremendous. And it's going to require a huge educational effort to make sure that our leaders are educationally equipped to lead the changes that all these institutions are trying to affect.
It seems like a lot of the disparities that you're pointing to have to be much worse in Oregon, given its history as an all-white state, given still the relatively small numbers of African-American people in the state.
Yes, Desiree, I agree. I think that when you talk about isolation, I mean, I think I've heard that word more than anything this summer. And, you know, at first I was kind of like, okay, yeah, it's COVID-19, we're wearing masks, we're socially distanced, the restaurants are closed, the movies are closed. And even within the medical centers, there's a lot of limitations in terms of our ability to socialize. So it's very isolating. And then I go before COVID. And I think as an African-American working here, when as OHSU, I had one other African colleague in the Department of Anesthesiology at OHSU. And I look at where I was working before OHSU, and there was no other African American that I was working with. And so while you have your colleagues, we have a lot in common in that I love anesthesiology. I practice in this field. I spent my whole life training to be an anesthesiologist. It's fantastic. And there's great collegiality in terms of that profession. But in terms of the feeling of being the only, very isolating. And then you add the vulnerability of being a resident or a trainee in an environment where there are very few like you. It's very isolating. It's one of the things that actually contributes to some people of color, African Americans, leaving the healthcare workforce. That's something that I think that here in Oregon, it becomes even more important that as African American residents, medical students, faculty come to Oregon, that these institutions need to make a much stronger effort to try to connect them to communities within Oregon so that they can thrive.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're talking also about a largely white cohort, right, that's getting their medical training largely in isolation from colleagues of color, then that's also creating the racism and cultural incompetence among the peer folks who are training as part of that cohort.
When you look at the business world, they've been looking at the benefits and diversity, and they kind of focus on a lot of the financial aspects of it, more in innovation, more financial success. And then a lot of these ideas have kind of trickled into medicine, looking at different aspects of it, innovation and research, helping to address more health disparities, helping to make sure that groups have more access. But there's also the intellectual stimulation of white, blacks, other people of color, international groups that are coming together and educating one another about one another's lives and getting some insight. This kind of insight is going to help these physicians become more empowered and more competent to be able to take care of the increasing diverse patient population that we're having. So the benefit is enormous of getting groups together and being able to engage with one another. But it does require some level of education and understanding one another's histories, one another's experiences, and one another's lives. So white faculty, white residents, white students have to be open to understanding the Black experience, understanding really it's American history, and understanding how we got to this point, and understanding how to get to the next stage. So the workshops that are being held, which OHSU has been doing, had a number of workshops available, WebExes and meetings and discussions. People have to be open to having these discussions, but then how to get to the next step.
I think this speaks also to undergraduate education and the need for really integrating work in comparative ethnic studies and the Black experience at the undergraduate level and BIPOC experience more broadly, right? So that as people are, they're getting some of that foundational knowledge earlier in their education as well. I just want to go back also to one of the comments that you were making about the percentage of Black residents who are dismissed. Black residents represent something like 20% of residents who are dismissed during their residency. Mm. That's a pretty shocking stat, especially in terms of what that means about the debt burden and the debt risk that Black students are taking on as they enter medical school, knowing that statistic down the road. And they're also coming in with less inherited intergenerational wealth to kind of buffer them.
Yes. So a lot of truths there. And it's very, very worrisome. And so the pressure is enormous. And so talk about, you know, how do Black trainees get through knowing this? They're very aware of this. Feel it, you see it. Although it's very alarming to me, I've seen the reality of it. And as faculty, I do everything I can to try to help promote making sure that residents do get through their training program. Many of them internalize a lot of the stress and the isolation and the bias that goes along with living today in the state that we have right now, not really quite being anti-racist and dealing with accepting all the microaggressions and internalizing them and trying to get through. They're doing everything they can to get through because they know they have a huge debt to pay when this is all done. And by the time they're a resident, they're already, their debt is astronomical. By the time I started residency, I was already over $100,000 in debt. Today, that's pretty much triple. It'd be great if we could decrease the tuition bill for sure, but we also have to make the space more supportive for these residents. Otherwise, we're not going to be successful and doing what everyone is trying to work towards achieving.
You know, I just wanted to point to what I think is a particularly striking marker of health disparities in Multnomah County, and that's that in a 2014 study, the Multnomah County Health Department found that the Black African-American infant mortality rate was 2.6 times that of non-Hispanic whites. It's a really troubling statistic.
That is. That really is. And I'm sure that there are a number of socioeconomic determinants that have contributed to that. And I don't know what things are going to look like after we start looking at what COVID has left behind. But I just can't imagine it's going to go down because it's even more difficult to affect care now, particularly kind of that routine kind of care as opposed to the urgent. Very glad that pregnant women were some of the first that were getting COVID tested. Even the hospitals that were not doing any elective cases, any woman that came in pregnant was tested as soon as the test became available. So that was included in the protocol compared to like testing of urgent cases versus not urgent cases. But they looked at any pregnant woman as basically in that urgent category and tested them, which I'm very pleased because if they were COVID positive, they addressed them very differently, did a lot more testing, just making sure that they were able to be healthy and be able to deliver safely. So I'm really glad that they did that. But I wonder about if there were any problems in terms of access to care for people from underrepresented groups is what I worry about.
Dr. Teilhard, I can't thank you enough for making time out of your incredibly busy schedule to speak with me today. My guest today has been Dr. Angèle Teilhard, who is a medical director of neuroanesthesiology and an assistant professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the OHSU School of Medicine. When we post this segment, we will also post a link to an article that she co-authored with her spouse, Professor Tabidi Lewis of Washington State University, Vancouver. This has been Desiree Hellegers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was a bit of Marvin Gaye singing Inner City Blues, preceded by a discussion between Desiree Hellegers and Dr. Angèle Théard of OHSU about COVID and racism in healthcare. Finally on our show today, we look back at history with a book review by book mole Larry Bolden, who tells us about The Orphan's Tale, a novel by Pam Jenoff, published in 2017. The story delves into the ingenious ways Jews were saved during World War II and the special role that circuses played. As usual, in these times of COVID, I will be reading for Larry. I know next to nothing about circuses or aerialists, but reading Pam Jenoff's fascinating novel, The Orphan's Tale, has me wanting to know lots more about both. This novel is about two women who, for very different reasons, are on the run during World War II. Noa is a young woman whose parents have kicked her out of her home because of an unwed pregnancy. Quote, "The girls' home where I lived after my parents found out I was expecting and kicked me out had been located far from anywhere in the name of discretion, and they could have dropped me off in Mainz, or at least the nearest town. They simply opened the door, though, dismissing me on foot. I'd headed to the train station before realizing that I had nowhere to go." End quote. When her very non-Aryan son is born with dark eyes and olive skin, she is not allowed even to hold him before he is whisked away. Working as a cleaner in the railway station, she lives in a tiny storage room. One night, she hears a sound coming from a boxcar. The sound continues to grow, almost a keening, like a wounded animal in the brush. When she slides the door of the boxcar open, quote, "There are babies, tiny bodies, too many to count, lying on the hay-covered floor of the rail car, packed close and atop one another. Most do not move, and I can't tell whether they are dead or sleeping." Unquote. But one baby has woven booties on, and on impulse, she grabs the now crying baby and takes it to the little storage closet where she sleeps. Once she realizes there is no way she can keep the child and still do her job, she runs away with it. The second woman, Astrid, is Jewish and comes from a circus family. She is married to a German officer who turns her out to save his career. Although her family circus is no longer together and, for all she knows, has been arrested or killed by the Nazis, another circus shelters her and takes her on as an aerialist, a trapeze artist. Noa stumbles onto the circus as she runs from the police, and she too is taken in by the kind circus owner, both she and her stolen baby given shelter. The two women with such completely different backgrounds start a relationship that begins in hostility but blossoms over time into a wonderful friendship. I will not give away much more of the story here, except to say that Astrid trains Noa to become an aerialist, and both travel by rail with the circus into Nazi-occupied France. As we learn from the author in her afterward remarks, the kernel of the novel begins from her reading two stories, one about a boxcar full of babies, the unknown children, who were, quote, "ripped from their families and headed for a concentration camp, too young to know their own names," unquote. And a second about a German circus that sheltered Jews during the war. The author obviously researched extensively about circuses in general and about the Circus Altof in particular. The reader is treated to long descriptions of how the circus travels from town to town, set up from scratch at each location. We readers are also given hair-raising descriptions of how the aerialists perform protected only by their skill and very inadequate nets. While it is obvious that author Genoff mainly wants to tell the story of how Jews were sheltered by German circuses, she develops her characters carefully and fully so the story itself is fascinating, quite aside from its political and moral messages. I am told by reader friends that there is a large circus community in Portland, and I find myself driven to learn more about the history of circuses and aerialists. This is a love story of the very best sort. It is heartwarming and frightening in equal measures. Although a fairly long novel, I predict that most readers will read it in a sitting or two. Once started, it is hard to put down. I have been reading this morning about Pam Genoff's novel, The Orphan's Tale. This is Patricia Kullberg, reading for Larry Bolden and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That's it for our show today. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Laurie Mercier, Chelsea Ratzliff, Desiree Helligers, and Larry Bolden for their contributions today. I would also like to thank our special guests, Joel Blyfus and Dr. Angèle Teilhard. We are especially grateful to the hardworking staff at KBOO who have kept this station going all these months under very difficult circumstances. Later on today, we will post a downloadable podcast of our show and the individual segments, along with additional material you may find of interest. We love to hear from our listeners. You can reach us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com or by sending us a message through the KBOO website. Please join us again next Monday morning for more commentary from the point of view of the 99% and a vision of a radically democratic world. Wear a mask, keep your distance, stay safe, and stay active. I'd like to go out today with a song by Víctor Jara entitled No Puedes Volver Atrás, or You Can't Go Back.
Puedes volver atrás, no tienes más que seguir. Que no te aturda el engaño, sigue, sigue hasta el final. La herida que va contigo, ¿quién la puede mejorar? Es la sórdida pobreza que se pretende ignorar. Es un mar amargo y negro que se tiene que aclarar.